We're coming to a really fun part of this course, which is the guru-disciple relationship. It goes on for some time, and we'll have some good times with it here. In the very beginning, the very first line of this is to read Whispers number 24, My Guru. So I thought we'd just start with Whispers number 24. I don't know if we'll get any farther than that tonight. Let me pull it out of the book so I can read it. Okay. Now, you know, before actually I read this, I just want to speak for a few minutes. Sometimes people ask, sort of, what makes our path different than other paths, or even just trying to talk to people about, you know, what is there about Ananda that is, there are not a lot of ashrams around these days or a lot of other choices, but still, what are the distinguishing features? And I got a letter, a question over the Facebook account just the last day or so, and the question was, some people say that meditation is just to make your mind stronger so you can be effective in the world. Some say it's just to relax your body, and that's the benefit of meditation. In other words, that you meditate in order to function better in the world. And I said, well, different meditations have different purposes. You ask different people and you get different answers depending on what they practice and how well they practice it. But Kriya Yoga is meditation with God realization as the goal. And that really puts the whole thing in a completely different perspective. Because if God realization is the goal, anything that happens to make your life better in this world is pleasant and is, in fact, a very profound and true side effect of meditation, because once you have self-mastery and the ability to concentrate, you can do anything you set your mind to. And that's why someone like Swami Kriyananda, who's such a good meditator and such a powerful disciple, is able to, you know, accomplish what almost seems superhuman, the amount of work that he can do. This 300-page book he just wrote about mastery, he just wrote it in 3 weeks. And that's really quite phenomenal, just to be able to just sit down and write at that level. But that's not the goal of our meditation. It's also in the way when we talk about the Ananda communities, and Swami Kriyananda was once introduced as the father of the communities movement in America, and he stood up and answered, I don't really care about communities. He said, what I care about is helping people to realize God, and communities are beneficial insofar as they will help us to realize God. And even the making of our Ananda communities has never actually been the focal point of what we're doing, but it is a natural byproduct of what we're doing. Because as we devote ourselves to God realization, our relationships with one another also fall into a very natural and harmonious order. For one, we begin to understand ourselves and each other as manifestations of the divine, which changes our whole way of seeing each other, plus our capacity to relate on a higher ego-transcending level is also cultivated by the kind of meditation we do, which is meditation with God realization as the goal, because everything becomes interiorized, concentrated, and uplifted. So the characteristics of the Ananda path are, one, that we have a technique of meditation with God realization as the goal, because many people who meditate, as I was saying, don't really have that. Their technique just doesn't take them that far, or they're not that interested. I know many years ago when the Findhorn community was really a big, making a big impact on the world, and I was at a gathering of communities, and the founder of Findhorn, Peter Caddy, was there, and I was there from Ananda. I'm an able representative of Ananda. I had materials to share, a slideshow and things like that. I couldn't get anybody to be the slightest bit interested in what we were doing. And they were much more interested in somebody who had 14 acres and hoped someday to get a community going, and the man who didn't even own his own property but was hoping he would find people who would help him buy it. And I actually said to Peter Caddy, why doesn't anybody listen to me? You know, we have so much more going on than any of these people. He said, they listen to you. He said, well, we promise them heaven on earth, but you tell them they have to transcend earth to get to heaven, and they're not interested. I thought it was an extremely apt, and it was the absolute truth. It was almost like they couldn't see me, is the only thing I could say. It was like people would just look right through me. It's like the message I had to deliver was not a message that they wanted to hear, especially like this was probably the early 80s or the end of the 70s. You know, it was a real, just a different reality. Even now, you know, Ananda has a certain invisibility because we don't emphasize the material side of what we're doing, so we're harder to see. It's changing, but slowly. So meditation with God realization is the goal, and discipleship. And, you know, and again, real discipleship, real ego-transcending discipleship. Many people are keen on spiritual progress and keen on all of the what they perceive to be what that looks like, you know, even to fixing the world and even, you know, to changing their own reality. But there aren't that many people who are keen on doing it by actually transcending the ego. Even sometimes if those words are there, it's really like swelling up the ego until it becomes the universal ego. And I don't mean that such people are ill-intentioned. It's just a lack of clarity, of just thinking that I'll just sort of be myself, only a better and better model of myself. You know, and we'll recycle and we'll be really good to one another and we'll be careful about our language and we'll be very tolerant and we'll be very universal and, you know, all of those sorts of ideas. But still, when you look at it, it's all just taking the same deck of cards and putting it in a different order. Whereas, and discipleship is one of those fundamental aspects that really makes the difference there. Because discipleship is really saying, well, it's saying two things that people are not necessarily wanting to say, which is really on the deepest level, I haven't the foggiest idea what I'm doing. And I absolutely must be guided and rescued by someone else. And the other half of it is that there is such a thing as individuals who are just way more advanced than I am. And so it's that whole concept. And it's really interesting how ideas get all mixed up, because an expansive idea is that we're all equal. And that's an expansive idea compared to caste consciousness and aristocracy and snobism and sectarianism, is to recognize that we're all equal. It's also a progressive spiritual idea to realize that everybody has the same potential. But then, like so many things in life, a good idea gets carried a little too far and then it becomes a bad idea. And that good idea that we're all equal becomes, I know as much as anybody. And why should I have to listen to anybody? I know as much as anybody. I have my own inner truth. You know, God speaks within me. I sometimes have had a very delicate sort of, I'm not quite sure how to help people who profoundly and deeply want to hear God's guidance, but have gotten the idea that the only person, the only way that God can speak to them is through themselves. Whereas, in fact, God can speak to us through many others. You know, that many people can speak God's voice to you. And in fact, most people find it a little difficult to hear God's voice clearly when I myself am concerned. Because when I myself am concerned, I often have lots of concerns that make it a little harder, whereas, you know, a reliable source outside myself can often see what's happening much more clearly than we can see ourselves. But this inner guidance, again, a good idea, gets carried too far. And then the understanding that somebody could really be capable of actually helping us, and then all the implications of that are really not easy for people to take, and they're not even popular right now. It's like the progressive spirituality of our culture, which was going along pretty well, has kind of taken a left turn off the path, you know, just kind of not quite going where it needs to go. So our commitment to being disciples is a unique contribution that we have to make. Now, it's interesting because Autobiography of a Yogi, of course, is one of the most influential books for any individual who begins to seek outside of the cultural norm in the West. If you sort of move outside of your traditional church anywhere, and I've said this before, if you're in any group of people who are doing something that's a little outside in a spiritual sense, you ask how many people have read Autobiography of a Yogi. You know, 3/4 of the room will raise their hand. And often when people find that you're part of Ananda, part of Master's Path, they'll say, oh yeah, I read Autobiography of a Yogi. I've had it on my shelf. I've read it several times. Now, Autobiography of a Yogi, the first sentence is, the eternal verities of India and the concomitant, and this is always the trivia question, disciple-guru relationship. The word disciple comes before the word guru, because you have to be a disciple before you will have a guru. So the concomitant, the characteristic feature of Indian culture has always been the search for eternal verities and the concomitant disciple-guru relationship, which is a very interesting sentence altogether. Once you start looking for eternal verities, you end up at the disciple-guru relationship. That once you start looking for the highest truth, you end up there. I mean, it's all right there. And then, of course, the whole book is about discipleship. It's about Yogananda's desire to know God, his search for his guru, finding Sri Yukteswar, my years in my master's hermitage, his relationship to Master Mahashaya, Master Mahashaya's relationship to Ramakrishna. You know, it's just all the way through. Lahiri, his disciples. But so often what people take away from that, and actually you were saying this to me just the other day, is so what a person wants to do is to go to India and meet one of those great souls. You know, and so it's like the first thought is, and the first thought is always, often, that, well, I need to get a God-realized master to guide me. And the concomitant thought that goes with it, I don't even know what that word means, but the thought that comes with that is nobody but a self-realized master could possibly guide me. And it's a teeny-weeny bit arrogant, but it is just sort of the thought that's there, that if there is such a thing, then I'm going to go right to the top. It's sort of like when we were taking these Nayaswami vows and other vows related to this renunciate order. I was talking to someone about what vow they were interested in. They said the Nayaswami vow. I said, why? They said, well, it's the top vow. And it wasn't really so much egoic as just, well, if I'm going to do it, I'll go all the way, you know. Well, but it might not be the appropriate vow, so maybe we should think about it a little differently. It was sort of like, well, if there's a God-realized master, I want the top guy to be guiding me. So on one hand, Yogananda has just permeated the culture with this whole guru image, just tremendously all the way through. It's very interesting, actually, just as a sidelight, that many people, what they take away from Autobiography of the Yogi is actually Babaji. That people who read it just like once through, Babaji's the image they remember. We actually played with that for a little while in our marketing, trying to sort of think that if Babaji is what people really know, maybe we need to, and for a while we had Babaji's picture on our magazine cover. We never really figured out how to work with it well. But I wanted to put Babaji's picture on the outside of our temple. I mean, these are just conversations. This was not like a tasteful idea. But I was just trying to think how to communicate in a flash what's happening here. And in many ways, Babaji makes a bigger impression on people because Yogananda is so self-effacing. And Babaji, of course, is so far out. In fact, somebody did one of those research things you can do. I think it was the people who came. I'm not sure if it was the people who came to some Ananda website or exactly how, but one of the most highly searched words in relation to our path is Babaji. That's what people start looking for. It might even be more highly searched than Yogananda, which is interesting, isn't it? And you know, when we all hear, I mean, talk about guru disciple climbing all the way to the Himalayas and finding the isolated camp of the deathless master and throwing yourself at the feet. I mean, who hasn't really thought that would be so fabulous? And then you go to India and you're just caught in all the smog and the rickshaws and it's just such a mess, and you just don't see anything like that anywhere. In fact, Swamiji was coming. He said, 50 years ago, which, you know, I'm almost exactly 40 years with being part of Ananda, and 40 years sounds long, but it doesn't sound long. You know, when you live it, it's just not long at all. It's one day at a time, and a day is only so long, and they add up, that's all. But Swami said, you know, 50 years ago, 60 years ago now, when he was in India, he said there were just a lot of great souls around that he would see and visit, Anandamayi Ma, among others, and just many. He said, now you just don't, you don't even hear about them. He doesn't know whether they're just not incarnated or whether they're hidden from view or up in the mountains or where they are, but he was able to go around just visiting many great souls, just as sort of in the course of things. But what was I saying with all of that? So another aspect of this, and this is, you know, I'm talking to our own family in this. This is not a, I'm not giving this class necessarily to people who've just walked in off the street. This is conversation for disciples. When I first started on this spiritual teaching, when Swami first started on this spiritual teaching, I remember telling Swamiji that, like this is in the early 80s, when I was beginning to go out and give lectures in the mid-80s, and we told him, you know, teaching classes on the chakras is just really popular. He was so intrigued. He said, heavens, when he was active, you know, teaching to the general public, which he was pulling back from even then, he said, you know, you couldn't give a class on the chakras. Nobody had the slightest idea what you were talking about. And now you can advertise something on the chakras even, you know, decades ago, and people were extremely interested. Now it's a common word. People, it's reached the point of total misunderstanding. That's progress, right? But just, you know, in a very short period of time, all of these things begin to evolve. So when David and I first moved here, which was, what, 1987, 88? We came at the end, the year beginning of 87. I have to stop and sort that one out. We just had to say that we taught meditation. And that was it. That was, you know, here's the picture that I always have in my mind. Swamiji has often talked about how change comes to society. That you have like the mainstream of society, and then you have, it's almost always a small group of people who work together and generate magnetism, whether it's the Renaissance in Florence or the left bank writers in Paris or the Transcendentalists in Massachusetts. You just get some group of people who work together and generate magnetism, and the society is going like this, and that acts like a little whirlpool, and it pulls the course over, and then it begins to flow through the center of that. And what starts out as a movement on the outside of the mainstream, if it's destined, it moves into it and then flows right through it. For some reason, this struck me as so comical. It's partly because I was in seclusion when it came to me. And sometimes when you're in seclusion, everything is a little heightened. I was in seclusion at the seclusion retreat, as it were, down in the little Lahiri cabin. And they had been bringing me my meals, but then the kitchen closed for some reason, so they just brought me some supplies. So all of a sudden I opened my little door and there's a whole bunch of stuff just piled there, and there was a box, like a General Mills box, I think, of breakfast cereal. But it was whole grain breakfast cereal. And to prove that it was whole grain, they had a picture of one of their little whole grain flakes on the front with a little note that said, larger than actual size. Which was part of what tickled my funny bone. But then, you know, it was just this great big flake, full-color flake, and you could see all the little elements of whole grain on it, right? It just made me laugh and laugh, because when I first started in all of this, which would have been 1966, one of my friends, actually one of the people who was responsible for introducing me to the spiritual path, was an accountant for General Foods. And he told us for a fact that you would be better off tearing up the box and putting milk on that and eating it in terms of nutrition, that you got more from the box than from what was in the box. You know? Yeah, it was the truth. And that was the beginning for those of us who were involved in that, you know, back to the land, organic foods, whole grains, and, you know, it was anathema to buy anything. You had to make everything. You made everything. You ground your own flour, you made your own bread, you made your own yogurt, you made your own ice cream, you know, just like there was nothing that you could buy. And for years, I even still, it's taken me a long time to realize that this is a packaged product that's okay. In fact, I went back to baking bread for a while, and then I realized that what I could buy was better, you know, than what I could make, which was just unheard of in those beginning years, because it was so radical. Vegetarian, you know, anti-pesticides, it was so radical. But we, a group of us, moved over here, and then society just started running right through us. And when I, you know, there's sort of a moment where you feel like you've won. You were part of that youthful revolution, and you won. Here is General Mills, larger than actual size, showing me a whole grain flake. It's like, we did it. We converted them. We converted them all. It was a great sort of moment of triumph, which I celebrated in solitude there. I mean, just for days, I would chuckle every time I saw the actual, larger than actual size whole grain flake. But that's what happened. It became ordinary. Now, when we came to Palo Alto in 1987, we, meaning David and I, Ananda was already here, we just had to say that we were teaching meditation. And that was it. You know, society was running here, and it was beginning to kind of notice that there was this meditation possibility over here. And what's happened in the 25 years or so that we've been here is that, you know, society has moved over into that. I joke about it now. It's not that everybody meditates, but everybody feels guilty if they don't meditate, which is a tremendous step forward. They all know they ought to. They still can't, but they know they ought to, whereas before it was considered hypnosis, potentially dangerous, you know, just all these other anti-Catholic, which it still is, but all these other things that it was. Anti-Christian. So society has moved over into our reality. But heavens, we still don't live anywhere near the mainstream reality. And one of the challenges I've seen in our position as master's disciples is that we have to keep moving over. You know, we can't just sort of celebrate that people have come a tiny fractional bit and now they use yoga to be healthy. They just haven't come anywhere near where we are. And I know we've had these conversations, some of us in groups, you know, like, what is the next part? Where is the next part? Is it Kriya? Is it discipleship? Is it master? Is it communities? I mean, like, what is it really? And we're still, Swami's really trying to get communities going, and there's a marginal interest, but by no means has society moved over, and it doesn't yet run right through that. It doesn't run right through Education for Life yet, although pain is beginning to move people over toward Education for Life. It's interesting, when you read the introduction to Swami's book, he basically says the parents are going to make this happen because the parents are going to see what's happening to their kids. And he said Education for Life is going to be a movement from the bottom up. It's going to be the parents are going to make that revolution. What's interesting to me about whole grain, larger than actual size, is that it was a completely grassroots movement. There was never any moment in which any government nobody did it. It just came out of the shifting of awareness of individuals. And when I was reading Education for Life not too long ago, there's just a little bit in there, and I noticed how Swami said it'll come from the parents. And partly instructions to us, don't worry about academia. That's not where it's going to come from. It's going to come from the parents. And it'll just be a gradual movement on the part of the parents. And I don't know, I thought it would be sooner. Although our school has suddenly become oversubscribed, which is really something, more students than we can handle. But I thought by now it would be bigger. But society will move over. But speaking back where I was, this issue of discipleship, and to a certain extent discipleship to Yogananda, because if indeed he is, as Swamiji and Master himself essentially said, the avatar for Dwapara Yuga, there will be a time in which society itself will run right through the middle of self-realization, just as it gradually ran right through the middle of Christianity and, you know, many other world-changing movements. It's always a little dicey to talk about things like that, but nonetheless, it's the truth. I remember Swami has said, I used to talk about the future of Ananda as I saw it, but I realized instead of inspiring people, it frightened them. He said, so I stopped talking about it. I remember sitting on his porch at the seclusion retreat when he still lived in that dome, which must have been the summer of 1971, because he moved out of that dome in the fall of that year. And I just sitting there, and he just talked about, you know, well, first we'll build in America. He actually hoped to build on both coasts, which we've never successfully really done. Both coasts of America, starting in California, spread to the other coast. Then we'll go to Europe, then we'll go to Australia, and from there we'll go to India. He said India will accept it more if it's international. India will be happy to step forward to be part of an international movement, would be less inclined to be part of an American movement. So we tried Australia, but it never quite took off. He felt that Australia just wasn't ready, was his actual words. But nonetheless, by the time we got to India, we were not just American. Yes, I did. What happened in Australia? We tried Australia. An Australian man and his wife and another couple went there. But Swami's conviction after their efforts and his visiting there was that the Australians are just not ready for discipleship as a culture. You know, they're just a little too independent and a little too anti-authority. He didn't feel, even though, of course, devotees are devotees and you find good devotees everywhere. But as a culture, it was hard to plant roots there because the people were not in the mood. So it's unfortunate because it's an English-speaking country and therefore, of course, is an easier access for Americans. You don't have to cross that. Maybe later. Maybe I'll go from India back to Australia. Who knows? But he would talk. He would just talk about it. It was all so clear to him. And, you know, then we were like living in bread trucks and, you know, big cars. I mean, you know, big school buses and tents and teepees and sheds and shacks. It was just like there was no reason to disbelieve it. But it was very little evidence on which to base it either. It was very, very vivid. Because I just still remember. I'd been living in Ananda 2 months, 6 weeks. And just like, wow. I didn't even have a passport. I'd never been out of the country. Just like, wow, this is fun. To me, everything at that time was, wow, this is fun. You know, I didn't know anything. Okay, but coming back to this, where we are, so the other side of the whole guru-disciple, okay, so what I was talking about is that we have this obligation to master, to be true representatives of what he's really teaching. And these are things that are like people who aren't really tuned into discipleship, they don't really quite know how to put all these thoughts together. So it has to be said in the right way, because this balancing, and this is what we're doing in this whole course, and especially in this next section, this understanding of how discipleship makes you more yourself is not something that everybody understands. And it's interesting, I think, now, and I've never thought about this before, but it's true that Yogananda emphasizes how different his temperament was from Sri Yukteswar's. How, you know, he was devotionally oriented and Sri Yukteswar was a Gyan avatar. He was the incarnation of wisdom, very impersonal, and Yogananda was such a devotee. But the more he tuned into Sri Yukteswar, the more he became his own nature. Far from attunement with the guru taking him away and making him some kind of a carbon copy, he became more and more of what he himself was destined to be. I don't know how you can explain that. It has to just be something that you intuit, and then you enter in on faith, and then you have the experience of it, and you just suddenly realize that the more attuned you are, the more free you are. The more attuned you are, the more individualistic you are, even though your mind, especially your ego mind, tells you that the opposite would be true. Swami's chapter in The New Path on attunement is such an interesting study about just receiving the guru's energy and how the more you rebel against it and try to protect your own status and capacities, the less you actually have of your own capacities. The actual reason for that is this. Swami said this not too long ago, and it really struck me at the time. He said, everyone is imitative. He said, we're imitative. And he he put that in a really big way, or else I thought of it later. I don't remember. I think he was the one who put it this way. Just think of it. I swim at the Y. I tend to swim in the mornings, and there's a group that also is there in the same pool that I'm in. They have half the pool. It's called the Little Splashers. And the Little Splashers are parents with, or grandparents or nannies or friends with little tiny children that they're bringing in to swim. I mean, you know, some of these babies are just a few months old. They range from a few months to a few years. It's actually just incredibly dear. I love to see them. And they're being introduced to the water in such a way that they'll never be afraid and that they're having fun and they do all this thing. There's this wonderful grandpa. He looks like an ex-Marine. I don't know if he actually is, but you know, he looks like that kind of guy. He's just a big, tough guy. He brings this teeny little grandson of his in every time, and he's so sweet with that boy. And they play in the water, and they do all this stuff together. But it was so interesting to me. This is just beside the point entirely, but after they swam today, I was sitting in the jacuzzi, and I was just looking out, and I always like to watch the babies. He had this little tiny kid on his lap, and he was drying the kid's hair, and no mother would ever have dried a kid's hair like that. I mean, he had these two big hands, and he was just rubbing that like this, you know, just totally, just, and the child was just, you know, enjoying it completely. But I was really thinking about how male and female are different, and this is a boy child. And so Grandpa was very affectionate, very sweet with this boy, but, you know, he dried the kid's head. His big hands are moving like this. I expected the kid to scream. He just comes up smiling, and the guy goes after his head again. Which David and I never had children or anything like that, but I do see how mothers and fathers must just have such different ideas about how to deal with kids. And, you know, both are needed. But anyway, let's see where I was, Wes. But that child, those children are not American or Chinese or Japanese or anything like that. I mean, the soul is none of those things. The soul has come in at the moment of conception. It's made this little tiny body. It doesn't know it's a boy or a girl. It doesn't even know it's a human being. It just sort of finds itself washed up on these shores, and it begins to imitate. Immediately, it begins to imitate. That's what it does. So you can, I mean, sometimes you see in this area, you see children that, you know, are clearly adopted because the cultural difference or the skin tone or it's just completely different between the parents and the children. You can see it's not a cross-cultural, it's just an adoption. And so there they are, but those children are going to grow up flawlessly American, because sometimes the adoptive parents of these children from Africa or Korean or various ones that you see are, you know, that sometimes they're really American parents, you know. All right, Edward, are you ready? You know, there's just like no tone of anything except just pure American. This kid's going to grow up just the same. And they'll have all the mannerisms of their people. And this woman, Jean Couch, who runs the Balance Center over wherever it is now, but she does it. She has very interesting work. It's all about posture. And she shows you all these pictures about how posture has changed over the centuries, over the decades, and how much children learn their posture from the people around them. And then every so often she'll show you a picture of a child who just refuses to imitate, but just has their own posture, just period, they're going to do it. She, you know, shows bent spines and hunched shoulders and all these different things. But she shows you, and then she shows you cultures in which posture is perfect, and all the children's posture is perfect too. Because we're imitative. We just get into that reality and we start doing what's around us. Yes, Adam?
So I'm asking this because you brought it up, and excuse me, it's been in the news actually a couple times very strongly recently. There was two news stories. One was this ad for J. Crew showed a mother painting her son's toenails neon pink.
Uh-huh.
And at least, you know, you'd think it'd just be, you know, Fox News and the conservative outlets, but most of the major news outlets were, you know, in this uproar about it, that is this big deal, and uh-huh. You know, John Stewart's making fun of it anyway. The other one was, and this is the one where I really have the question, was this woman's son who has an extreme affinity and has always since birth towards like being a princess, basically shiny things, dressing up like a girl, you know, and just has that in, and they always try to, you know, lovingly, and I listen to the parents talk, they're clearly good parents, but just trying to steer him in the direction of being more of, you know, a boy, and, you know, do boyish things, and he never would have it, and they eventually just gave up because that tendency was so strong. My question comes in, you know, because you're talking about coming into the body and not knowing you're a boy or a girl, just having these tendencies, and obviously that's coming from a past life. So my question is how do you really explain that karma? In the sense that, you know, they're obviously going to have to deal with being ostracized, to deal with being, you know, almost singled out in that sense, and going through it. And is that just that they were so closely identified with their gender role in their most recent life, and it's just sort of a carryover? How do you explain that?
That's a complicated question, but we'll diverge for a moment and talk about it. We are not always male or female. We switch around. And so a person who was really, 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 really over-girlish and really over-attached or misused the female body or any kind of things or just simply needed to get more balance could easily be born into a male body without any inclination toward it. It's also possible, and I don't know how old this child is, that because often it takes us a while to figure out where we are. So you could come in with this strong remembrance of, you know, maybe, I mean, you could make up lots of scenarios. Maybe that soul died fairly young and was just in the middle of just beginning to explore the pleasures of being female and all the fun of it, and then suddenly died for some reason and just isn't done. They're just like on a trajectory where maybe life ended suddenly and they just are suddenly in this baby boy body, but their awareness is still in the last incarnation. A master says for the first 5 or 6 years of your life, the things that you're interested in those early years are very often an indication of what you were in your last life. So to come in and just want to be a princess and dress up like a girl could just simply mean that's just where they came from. There was this woman here, a girl, baby girl here, and she never looked like a baby. She just never seemed to get that she was a baby. She, from the very first, she had a kind of beaked nose and this extremely imperious air, and she always seemed a little annoyed. You know, like, where are my servants, was the look that she had on her face all the time. And even as a little toddler walking around, she was the most unbaby-like thing, just completely like this. I joked with her parents. I said, she's beginning to look more, when she was about 2 or 3. She's going to look more like a little girl and less like an imperious old woman wondering where the servants are. She said, then her mother said, that's because she found her servants, her father and me, you know. And she treated them like that. She didn't treat them like parents. She treated them like servants. It was just her mindset. And then as a few years passed, she began to actually sort of figure out that she wasn't really an old woman anymore. She was now a little girl. And she became a little bit more of a little girl. Sometimes, you know, there's a few kids in our school. There's one little boy. He has just, well, I remember when Swami came to visit once, there was one little Indian boy, about 3 or 4. Well, he couldn't have been 3, so he must have been 4 or 5 years old. And Swami just looked at him and said, well, you're not a boy. You're an old man already. You know, he just had a complete man's face. And the boy just kind of regarded Swami in this way, but he just didn't have a child's face. He just had a man's face on a little body, and it was kind of miniature scale, but that little boy had just never, like, really quite gotten into this childhood thing. He just hung on. That's how I intend to be next time. I want to be 60 when I'm 3. I want everyone to say she was never a child. She just was an old woman from the start. Let's not waste time. Let's just go right to it. But so yes, it could be, and then it could either be something that soul just outgrows. It could be that child is just going to be an extremely androgynous person, you know, comfortable in the body that they have, but not bound by it, and just perfectly willing to live anywhere in the spectrum of the yin-yang reality. Or it's going to be one of these people that they actually have a psychological name for, which is, what is it, gender? There's a word for it, but it means gender, pardon me? Gender disorder, where you're just dysphoric, okay, where you just really like you're in a male body and you're so female that, you know, now that they'll actually switch your body with hormones, and that's a pretty difficult road to walk. And it's arguably not necessarily the best road to walk because the soul doesn't really make a mistake. However, it's just a little confusing, you know? People just, and that's where homosexuality comes from, and it's just, and none of these things actually really matter that much because they're really superficial compared to the soul. And if you're just born with a certain orientation and that's just really how you feel, no matter what your body is, you can only fight against it for so long, and then you just have to say, "That's just what I'm doing. Let me just do it." Now, why people do that can be very, very complicated. I mean, people can... there's a few people I know who have different gender or sexual orientations, and my perception with some of them is that it has really nothing to do with sexual orientation, but they needed to put themselves in certain positions in relation to society. They had certain independence or anger or discrimination issues that this was a very good way to act out. You know, it could have a whole lot of different reasons that you just set up a construct that allows you to face and deal with certain things that you have to face and deal with. And so you can't just say, this means this, this means this, this means this. You have to stop and say, what is the actual effect of this event on the consciousness of the individuals involved? And then that begins to tell you what it's about. And it can be very different for different people, just depending on what they're working with. But they have found the body influences you a lot. Not only does the body itself influence you, meaning the hormones and the just the way the whole thing is built and all of that. You know, most men are stronger and more outwardly oriented than most women. It's not, of course, true these days. You see those, you know, women basketball teams, and you know, these girls who are making their bodies, you know, 6'4", 6'6", and these huge, strong women. It's a very interesting age that we're living in, all these women athletes, and it's such a, there's just so many really strong, tall, forceful women. It's just like you don't know what society is heading for. It's very interesting. I don't mean that in a bad sense. It's just very interesting. As one of my tall friends who was like 5'7", said, in my junior high, she said, I could stand and look over the heads of everybody in seventh grade because she hit her height early, but now 5'7 is just ordinary. You know, women are not tall at that age, that size. They have to be much taller. It's Dwapara Yuga. But let's see, let me get the last part of that out. But a lot of times, parents who are determined to raise their children in a certain way, you know, they give their boys dolls, they give their girls trucks, and the girls reject the trucks and go for the dolls, and the boys reject the dolls and go for the trucks, long before there's anything affecting them. They're just, you know, the mother or the father has kept them in this tiny little protected environment, but they have a karmic inclination, either gender-oriented or whatever it might be. One of my friends raised their daughter, and they so didn't want her to be over-feminine. You know, they wanted her to be very androgynous. This was at Ananda. They never bought her a single piece of jewelry. By the time she was 6, she had 100 pieces of jewelry that she would bring out and count on a regular basis. And she loved and admired every one of them. The parents never bought her one, but it was just by her sheer magnetism, she just pulled them to her. You know, she was going to have her destiny in spite of them. And, you know, and they'd try to put her in jeans, and she always insisted on wearing dresses. I mean, she just had her own reality. This is completely off the subject, but one of my young friends, when she was really young, she was about 8. Actually, she had her 8th birthday. Let me think how that went. Yes, she had her 8th birthday, and I'd lost track of the years. I said, your birthday's coming up. How are you going to be 7? She drew herself up to her complete height and said, 8? No one who knows me would think I was only 6 now. Just like, it was so, you know, don't ever think these people aren't complete just because they're small. The same child, it was at Ananda, and it was an Indian sort of thing, and her mother dressed her in this beautiful sort of Indian outfit, and I said, my goodness, dear, you look just like a princess. And she had dark features, beautiful child. You look just like an Indian princess. No, I don't, she said. Oh, I said, you look like you're from Rajasthan. You look like a Rajputani princess. No, I don't. Just, she was getting really irate with me. So I sort of looked at her and she said, princesses have no power. I'm a queen. She had it figured out. Okay, now, what I was saying before we did all this, which was important, was that we get into an environment and we begin to imitate it. And this is the statement that, and so Master even talks about that, although Master was, of course, completely free, but he talks about, and this is a line or two in Autobiography of a Yogi, lying in the crib, and from the multitude of languages going on in his head, he gradually figured out that Bengali was the one that was being spoken around him. So he chose Bengali out of everything that was going on in his consciousness and began to lisp in Bengali because that was what he was supposed to do. And so we begin to imitate the sounds that we hear, the mannerisms that we see, the table manners, the posture, the preferences. One of my friends, her little baby used to really like curry. You know, babies don't usually like curry at all, but she could feed her small child fairly hot curries. It was just very strange. He was just Indian from his past lives, and he just liked the taste of it. And, you know, Japanese children will eat Japanese food that American children might find really icky because we're just imitating. It's not inherent like that. So for any individual to really become non-imitative, you have to, when you really stop and think about how profound the imitation is and how far back we have to go to actually be responding according to our own soul nature. Now, of course, as I was saying, the body influences us, the culture influences us, but that those influences can be more or less defining depending on how far we've gone back to our point of origin. And that's the point that Swami makes about the word original. That people tend to think that to be original means to do things that haven't been done before. But oftentimes, people who are trying too hard to be original are actually still just being imitative. They're just picking up something that isn't mainstream, and they're doing this over here, but often, you know, all the hippies who were rebelling all dressed the same. And so they were trying to be so different, but they're all like each other. We were all like each other out there, just sort of doing that. But when you become really original, is when you have really stepped away from all that externally imposed response and actually have whatever your responses to life be, actually be consistent with the real inner trajectory of your own soul nature. And you see, that's what the guru enables you to do, because the magnetism of the guru pulls you away from what you thought you were and pulls you into what you actually are. Because the magnetism of the guru pulls you into out of your senses, out of your mind, into your spine, and into your spiritual eye, into the real origin point of our nature. And then everything that comes from there is really who we're meant to be. And so often when the ego self and the mind and the cultural conditioning rebels against that discipleship in the name of being my own self, what you're actually doing is you're defending the imitative part of yourself. And in the early years of Ananda, when Swami Kriyananda was writing music and he wanted us to learn and sing his music, and there would just so many things that would happen in those years. There would be people who would say, well, I write music too. And I remember Swami would say this. It took me a while to understand it. He said, that almost without exception, he said, their music is not original, it's imitative. You know. And I would hear that, and I couldn't quite get what he meant. But it was imitative. It was similar in style to this one's or that one. And the person would think it was so original because it had come out of them. But he didn't. It was a very subtle point to grasp. How could it be imitative? I wrote it myself. And, you know, and so-and-so never wrote words like these words. But it was still imitative because it wasn't yet coming from that point of origin. And he, and it was a little awkward for him to insist that we only do his music. But what he was trying to do is, because his music really comes, as we all can tell now, just comes from somewhere else. And he wanted us to get in tune with that music. And once we got in tune with that music, what it would put us in tune with is the point of origin. And then what would come out of us would be genuinely original. And it wouldn't necessarily sound like his music, or it might, but it would be genuinely original from us. And that's why it's interesting in the repertoire of Ananda music, almost all of it is written by Swami, but there's a chant here and a song here, you know, just a few things here and there that have made the cut. Because just by our own collective intuition, those songs have endured because they were a genuinely original presentation. And somehow or another, the vibrations of those have been able to stay with us. And they weren't always, you know, no one has written a whole repertoire, but an individual here has written one, this one's written one, this one's written two, you know, just little bits and pieces that we managed to catch it, you know. More people at Ananda have been able to write. Swami himself laments partly that he's done so much of the music that there hasn't really been, not yet, as much next generation of music writing. There's begun to be a lot of book writing. You know, the book writing is really beginning to happen from a lot of different sources, but the music writing hasn't happened yet, but it will. It just hasn't happened yet, but it has to, and it will. Let's take a break, then we'll come back and deal with something else, okay? Do we have any questions? Yes, Chidambar had one.
Yeah, I had a question about Swami, and did he comment about the fact that this came through him? His music, because it wasn't clear to me, you know, 25 years ago where it came from.
I don't mean to be such a just sort of raging sentimentalist as I've become lately, but there's just this passage of time and this sort of old person's kind of looking back nostalgically. And so I saw this little film clip of Swami. They're collecting all this archival footage and everything for the film that they're doing. It was just a one-minute film clip that Vijay made of Swami coming out of the temple at the seclusion retreat. And he just strode out. It was early summer, early 70s. He strode out. He was wearing a dhoti. He bent over. He picks up his sandals. He stands on one leg. And the dhoti moves, and you see this incredibly strong, muscular leg. He had such a strong body. He slips his sandal on, you know, just one-legged like this. Whoa, you know, Swami can't even get out of a chair now. And his little legs are, you know, it's just like nothing like that. Just all this energy and power and youth, nothing but youth. And then there's a corresponding difference in the entire consciousness of Ananda in those beginning years. Because Swamiji was never willing, I mean, he's written a book on supportive leadership, and one of the rules of supportive leadership, which is a very important one for people in our positions, is the last resort of a weak leader is to claim some special authority and special source of wisdom that no one else can access. Because then you get your power over people by completely emasculating them. You know, my intuition tells me, God tells me, Guru tells me. One of my friends once was doing a very unpopular thing, and he just was trying to communicate to people that he was doing it because God had told him to do it. And most people thought he was wrong in his decision. It was a personal decision, but everybody has an opinion in a community. And I said to him, you know, you're putting all your friends in a very tough spot. Because they not only have to deal with your decision, but they have to deal with God's decision. And even if it is God's decision, maybe you don't want to say that. Because it doesn't give us any place to go. We can't converse with you about it. People need to converse with you. But in a leadership position, when the leader says, You know, I have special powers, I have special access, I have special guidance, then everybody else just has to take it, because they're opposing God if they oppose you. And Swamiji, being a brilliant leader, and also wishing not merely to rule, but also to elevate and train others. You see, if Swami had taken that position from the start, which almost all spiritual people in his position do take, and it has been more or less the way most of the other ashrams of his contemporaries, who are almost all now off the planet. Sai Baba died on Easter Sunday. Some of you may or may not know that, but almost all of Swamiji's contemporaries are gone. And most of them took that position. I'm the guru here. And since you're the disciple, but as a result of that, and I don't want to make this too universal, but I'll quote David Frawley. David Frawley, who has traveled to all the ashrams in the world virtually of our ilk, basically said he thought Ananda was the only one that was going to outlive its founder. Because he has actually trained leaders and actually given them the capacity and the freedom and the authority to actually act on their own. So, this is a long answer, but I really need to bring Swami into this discussion of discipleship. And this morning when I was looking at all this, I thought, you know, I really have to bring Swami into this, and we're going to bring in some other writings in order to make that true. When Swami wrote these notes, he wasn't a factor, but in our discipleship, he is a factor. Let me just find my thought there. I lost it for a second. People have asked me, we had this discussion in our Monday night meeting recently, if Swami's different now than he was when I first met him, because I always talk about having first met him, you know, and my immediate connection. And my answer is that literally, from the first moment I saw him until yesterday and today and tomorrow, he's always seemed just the same to me. I've just never seen him, or I've never experienced him different. But he expresses himself very differently. It's not that he is different, but he now expresses himself very differently. Because for many, many years, he just wouldn't bring it explicitly forward. Because to have done that would have changed everything. And he just wasn't, he didn't see that as the best way to serve us. I mean, it's in my book, I quote him as saying, "I've always thought I could do more good for people as a simple, unaffected friend than in any other role." And in that context, he was more or less saying, that, of course, isn't really the role that I have, but I always thought that would be the best way to play it. And so in those early years of Ananda, he was very determined to awaken within us an intuitive understanding of what he was never going to say out loud. So that when people actually came to an understanding of what was really going on there, and I don't just mean him, but just sort of everything about what was really going on there, our relationships to master, what discipleship really meant, what our real duties and responsibilities were, that it wouldn't be imitative, that it would actually be from our own point of origin. One of the most dismaying things to me is when I observe that people assume attitudes that when people's attitudes toward Ananda, toward the spiritual path, toward Swamiji, are imitative rather than discovered. You know, even things like, and there's nothing that can be done about it, people come to get the blessing and they'll open their arms out like this, and then I'll see the next person will do the same. Now, of course, that's a natural way to receive something, but it always makes me slightly nervous. Like I don't want people to be looking the same when they do things. Because I just want to make sure that whatever they're ending up doing, it's because they actually felt it rather than they saw it. And the relationship to Swami, which isn't a very complicated, when he never asserted his position and almost no one had asserted it for him, if you grew to respect him and really felt that he had spiritual magnetism to convey, It was because you had just, you'd really figured it out, and you felt it. And it was like a secret. It was really funny. It was like you just never could really talk about it. You sort of say it really quietly, one to another. I remember a woman came to me and she said, "It all emanates from him, doesn't it?" I said, "Yeah, but don't talk about it." "It all emanates from him. Yeah, but don't talk about it," I said. I mean, I remember literally, I said, "Yeah, but don't talk about it." What were you going to say?
So I find this,
I'm coming back to the music in a minute.
A little baffling. I'm not sure if I understand this. But so the question would be, so if Swami is who he was, has always been the same.
Right.
Does that mean that he hasn't spiritually grown at all, that he is the same in wisdom and knowledge in his 80s that he was in his 40s,
50s? In his birth?
His birth,
yes,
that is
pretty much what
no growth, no well, change. Would that? I mean, that would suggest to me that he is everything potentially he could ever be already was ever.
Isn't yes, it does, like an, doesn't it?
It's kind of like being an avatar.
Jivan Mukta. You know, I mean, yeah, it's a good question.
So, are you born a Jivan Mukta?
Sure, of course you are.
Yeah.
But you must have to deepen it as you go.
I don't know.
I find that
hard. I don't. I'm in an awkward position to declare, but Swami himself has often quoted to us, and you know, you start thinking after Swami tells you the same story for the 40th time that maybe there's something there you should really hear. And one of the things he's repeated pretty often at the Christmas meditation when Master was still living, was it 1948, 49, somewhere in there, that Master said, "There are a few siddhas and quite a few Jivan Muktas in the room now." And so you stop and think, and Swami himself has said, well, who were they? And he talks about who was there. You know, and he never finally finishes by putting his name at the bottom of the list, but he asked Master, you know, "Will I find God?" He said, "Yes." I mean, will I be liberated? That was the question. It wasn't a question of, you know, will I have a nice experience. But so if, but that would suggest that to be liberated means you're already a Jivan Mukta, because a Jivan Mukta is already freed but is allowing the karma to run, but has no ego to which that karma is attached, and is allowing the karma to run so that he can incarnate for the sake of others. I mean, it's just like, I mean, I'm, you know, I know this is on a recording, and when I put anything on a recording, it goes out for a long time. This is, it's an interesting question. Who is this man? You know, and when I read, and when I, and this is just, you know, my incredibly uninformed, and who am I to say? What I've said from the very beginning of all of this is, when people would say, I'm coming back to where I started, well, Swami can't guide me. He's not fully self-realized. He says so himself. And I say, well, the difference between Swami and Master is not obvious to me. The difference between Swami and me is very obvious to me. So until I bridge that gap, I'm not going to worry about the other part of it. And then more recently, Swamiji has written more explicitly about these stages. He wrote about it in the Bhagavad Gita commentary and others. You know, just really explaining sort of, and you know, my own understanding had been pretty fuzzy before then. You know, what does it really mean? And he says a Jivan Mukta has the same state of consciousness as a siddha or as an avatar. But the power of a Jivan Mukta to help others, as an avatar is unlimited, and a Jivan Mukta, but the state of consciousness is more limited, but the state of consciousness is not the same. I mean, I'm just quoting as an avatar, is the same as an avatar, excuse me. But the mission is a little different. So I just sort of end up like, And this is also, I was talking to actually someone today, excuse me for just a minute, and they were talking about hoping that this was their last incarnation, this girl said. And it wasn't in that context, and I said this to her, so I don't mind saying it here. I don't think it was all that helpful, that thought, so I tried to correct it. I said, well, if it's your last incarnation, you look like Swami or Rajasi or Gyanamata. That's what it looks like when it's your last life. So I don't mean to be discouraging, but, you know, if it doesn't look like that, it might not be. That doesn't mean we can't become Jivanmuktas now. Master said that we could. Swami's encouraged us to think that way. But we may not be there yet. So we're, okay, what was the question that Adam has?
Well, it more comes back to a matter of what Master talks about when I hear him on recordings and then what Swamiji talks about. I mean, Master talks about the state of samadhi quite often.
Right.
And I haven't heard Swamiji.
Swamiji says that it's not to be given to him. Master said death is the final sacrifice. But at the same time, Swamiji has never talked about it. He's never claimed it. He's never made any point of it.
He said he thinks he had samadhi in a prior life.
In a prior life. He had sabbakalpa samadhi in a prior lifetime. But he's never made ever any point of his own state of realization until recently, when he now talks all the time about just being so overcome with bliss that he can't contain himself. And he,
the first time I heard him say something.
Consciousness book. He said, I was in super consciousness when I wrote that book.
Yes, and also there is that, which I also put in my book, when Swamiji talks about his childhood merging into the light as a baby. And then after I met Master and learned to meditate, and I went back into that super conscious state and found that it was the same as it had always been. So he sort of just like runs these little things through the story. And I really, because I'm not the only, but I am one of his biographers, I have always remembered and paid attention to all of these things. And I'm always weaving them together in my mind, trying to sort of think where this comes from.
We're learning who he is from the inside out, not from the
I think so. And he's, you know, he's very sensitive to, he's very sensitive to many things, not the least of which is that it's very important that this work be established around Master. But that doesn't mean, and this is where, you know, when we get through more of this lesson, it's really all right in here. It's like, how do we access Master? And Swami's written in many places, well, obviously you access the Guru through those who are in tune with him. As Swami says himself, you have a hair, you have a little bit of the shirt, and you just hold it to yourself and you're so pleased with it. He says, what about a whole person, you know, who's been magnetized by the Master? That's a really good place to get the energy. And of course, then there's many, much more than that, but it's all part of it. So coming back to the music, which is what the question you asked, you know, he just didn't want to say a lot of things he could have said because he didn't want to impose it. He wanted people to support what he was doing because we wanted to support what he was doing, not because we had no choice about supporting what he was doing. And he also talks about, but it was so absurd because he was so reticent to assert leadership that when he would assert leadership, people would think he was being presumptuous for asserting leadership. And it would just be, it was just crazy. It was totally crazy. And it took about, you know, a decade or a little less to sort itself out, including, and he talks about the meeting, about the publications building when he, that building which is now Hansa Temple, and he got money was given to him to build that building, and he had let the community people, especially the people who just were not in tune at all, sort of do planning and things like that. And according to all of their plans and according to them, that was right where the building should be. But then there was this just enormous brouhaha about putting the building there, even though he'd followed all the little rules that all the people, all the little one-horse people around him had done. And then and this was very soon after I came. I'd been there a very short time. And he called this meeting, and he says later that he called the meeting because he knew he had the majority. He had the majority support. He could declare an ultimatum and know that he would win. He wouldn't have declared it if he didn't think he could win. But I hardly knew him and didn't know anything that was going on. So we had this round meeting, sitting in a circle meeting inside the temple at the seclusion retreat. It seems to me like it was winter. When I try to figure this out, I can't remember right now, but you know, I sort of, there's been disagreements about when this meeting was, but I mark it by certain things because I was there and I remember other conditions. But anyway, we were there and he said, essentially, look, sometimes when I say I want something, You have to listen to me. And if you don't listen to me, I'm just going to leave. And so I'm just completely literal. I've just moved up there to be with him, and he's about to leave. And then what happens is all these other people just start talking as if he hadn't said that, as if the issue was still up for discussion. And somewhere in the middle, and I know now, because I'm a little more astute, that there was a lot of people who were with Swamiji in that room, I mean, with him in spirit. But they knew what I learned later, which is sometimes you just watch for a minute and see how he's going to play it out.
You don't just
jump in and think you know. Sometimes you have to let it play itself out a little. But I didn't know that. So they're all going for a few minutes. And then finally, I can still hear my own voice because this is what it sounded like to me. Didn't you hear him? He says he's going to leave. Like that. I was just absolutely panicked. And, you know, and then that sort of was the signal, and then a lot of other people spoke up, and the whole thing sorted itself out. But I just, like, I didn't know what was going on. It was so strange. But then, of course, over time, of course, he talked about it often, and then he later seriously said to me, Asha, I never would have said that if I actually thought that I couldn't have turned the meeting. But I was so young, I didn't know any of that yet. But, you know, that was like, and then like 30, 40 people walked out of that meeting and walked out of the community and never came back. But, you know, it was time to just sort of, because at the beginning, as he said, if you can't have a community unless you have somebody there. So it was just like anybody. And there was just huge division of people who basically thought it was their community, and then this little tiny, smaller group of people who were the real founding members who knew it was Swami's community, and we just had to work all that out. But in the context of the music, with all of that, he wasn't going to say, you know, that I just heard this music, that it was given to me by Master, that it's the vibration of our path, that it's the expression of, you know, our new reality. He wasn't going to say any of that, because what would we have done with that information except just suddenly have to do it because we couldn't challenge it? So he just wanted us to get used to it and to hear it and to become subtle enough in our own understanding. And he just had a few songs then. I mean, he wrote more and more over time to really understand where this was going. But he knew the best way to take us there was to have people sing it. And the more they sang it, the more they began to understand it, and the more they sang it right, the more we began to hear it. And he was very stern with the singers. They would get up and sing during Sunday service, and he would stop them. That was wrong. That's not how that's supposed to be. You don't have that note right. And there was all this, like, upset about how he would embarrass people and so on. The singers themselves didn't mind. But everybody else would get very agitated. But he needed them to apply themselves and really get in tune with it and not turn it into something that was a more familiar sound to them. You know, they would change the notes, or they would change the rhythms, or they would pronounce the words, you know, with a twang, you know, things like that, that would just bring it back to the consciousness that we were more accustomed to. But he really wanted to push it into that new consciousness, but he didn't explain any of that. He would just let that all happen. Okay, well, I never got to whisper number 24, but we'll do that next time. All right. Okay, very good. Thank you all.